Hi, everybody, and good evening. Welcome to your own Brooks Show. We're broadcasting again from London. I again apologize for the lighting and the ambiance. I have very little control of the lights in my hotel room. This is the best I can do. It's 10:30 at night here. The blinds are closed. I depend on the lights, and they are where they are, and the levels are preset. That's the way the hotel functions. So hopefully the fact that I have this kind of weird lighting going on is not too distracting for you guys. So welcome again, and we'll be doing we'll be about an hour, maybe a little under an hour today, not more than an hour, I promise. And a lot to cover. Let me just start by a general evaluation of London. You know, I spend a lot of time here. I come here, I don't know, three, four times a year, turns out. Usually I'm in and out in a day. This is probably the longest I spent in London in a very long time. I can't remember when I was longer than this. I'll be here almost 2 weeks, about 10 or 11 nights total. 2 nights in Oxford, 9 nights in London itself. And I have to say, I love this city. I find this city, it's dynamic, it's exciting, it's energetic, it's got more culture and more stuff going on than any city I know of. I don't know any city where you can go to three classical concerts in one day, which I could have done today. I didn't have the time because I had some meetings, but I didn't do. I did go, and I'll get to that, to see Joshua Bell tonight, but there's so much going on. You walk here around, just like it's a little like New York. You go outside at midnight, at 1 o'clock, at 2 o'clock, there are people in the streets, particularly around where my hotel is. And there's a certain dynamism, vibrancy. It's a tourist town. There are people from all over the world, which I, for one, find fabulous and interesting and fun to see all the different people here. It's also it's become like a long time ago. I remember coming when you came to London, you almost had to bring your own sandwiches, right? Because the food here was so bad, right? All they had was British food, and British food, classical British food, is generally pretty disgusting. It's bland, it's uninteresting, it's unsophisticated, and it's just awful. But over the last 20 years, probably a little longer than that, there has been a massive food revolution in London, both in terms of British food itself has improved dramatically. People like Gordon Ramsay and Jamie, I forget his family name. Anyway, a bunch of British chefs, a new generation of British chefs, have come and completely modernized British cooking and British cuisine. They've integrated it with Asian and French and brought in all kinds of spices from all over the world and really made it some of the most interesting food in the world. But not only that, you walk down a street in central London, pretty Amiot streets, and there are restaurants, all kinds of restaurants, every imaginable type of restaurant. More so, I think, now than even New York City, I think. I mean, maybe the numbers don't match up, but it feels that way. And the restaurants are modern and clean, and they look good. And I've eaten since I got here. I've eaten at a so-called Israeli restaurant. It's really a Middle Eastern restaurant, but it's run by an Israeli celebrity chef. I've eaten at a Spanish restaurant. I just today ate at a Peruvian restaurant, and they were all superb. I mean, excellent. Really, really good food. And I'm kind of a foodie. So the food is fantastic. The options are unbelievable. I mean, you guys who live in London, if you're willing to spend some money, it's expensive. London's an expensive place. Wow, I mean, it's a great place to live. And then I had a whole choice of what kind of music to go to listen to, from opera to whole symphony orchestras to chamber music. And today I want to see Joshua Bell, who's a violinist, and do some violin and piano sonatas. Three sonatas, one by Mozart, one by Richard Strauss, and one by Schubert, and then some little pieces by Clara Schumann, by Brahms, and by why something with a W, a famous violinist from the 19th century with a W that I can't remember its name. And wow, I mean, it was fabulous. The music is so good, and the contrast. One of the great things about the program they put together is first there was no modern junk. That's always a huge advantage. But they put a program together that's interesting, kind of a classical piece in the classical period. Yeah, Wynowski, somebody on, he's great. I love his music. Anyway, if you find his violin concerto, Wienawski, find his violin concerto, out of this world. It is so amazing and hard to play. So, because he was a violinist, so he made it really challenging. Anyway, Mozart from the classical period, pretty. But a little constrained, a little restrained, not constrained, restrained, not very emotional, not very sweeping, and beautiful, flowing, pretty. I would say pretty is the thing you want to say. Then all the way to the end of the Romantic period, really the end, a young Richard Strauss, who's still a little bit on the Romantic before he goes kind of flirting with modern stuff too complex for me to enjoy anyway, but his early stuff is really good. He's still in that romantic tradition, but the end of the romantic, so bombastic and dramatic and passionate and melodies that are complex. You have to really pay attention, and but tension, huge tension and drama and suspense, and the music just sweeps you. It's just fascinating, and then. To Schubert, the beginning of the Romantic period, I mean, nobody wrote chamber music like Schubert. Schubert is the master. He's best at it. He's fantastic, particularly quartets, quintets, violin sonatas, just beautiful. Him and Schumann and Brahms, that is the pinnacle. And then, of course, you've got trios by Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, but really Schumann. Schubert, Schumann, Brahms are the heart of the Romantic period, and the music they write is beautiful, dramatic, passionate. This was a romance. It was, oh, just beautiful, and the guy played it so magnificently. And the nice thing about Joshua Bell, I don't know if you've ever seen him play, is that he brings his whole body into the performance. He really plays the music, and he's a good-looking guy. And he just the way he stands with the violin and the way he plays, it's just an aesthetic experience just to watch him. And you know how I always say I really love the Olympics because I love to see human ability and human talent, the physically and knowing that the kind of the effort that goes into it. Well, classical music is even 100 times more so. I watch these violinists, I watch these pianists, and the skill that goes into what they do, the hard work, the amount of work that they have it to engage in order to get to do what they do. And then the spiritual effort, the education, the understanding of the music, the understanding of the emotion that the music is trying to convey, and their willingness to really succumb to the music and to make themselves one with the music so that they can bring out magnificent performances. I think that's unique, more unique to classical music, more prevalent in classical music than it is in popular music, because classical music is so much deeper and so much more emotionally intense. But it's just astounding to watch. Here's a violin. I don't know if you've ever tried to play a violin. It mostly makes noise. If you've ever heard somebody young just practice the violin, it is awful. It is noisy. It is, and to watch somebody extract from this instrument just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful music that moves you, and that is both beautiful and dramatic and passionate and intense and makes you feel and makes you think and just sweeps you into it. And of course, the accompanying of the piano is incredibly powerful. But the violin, an instrument that is not easy at all to make beautiful. Is truly, truly magnificent. And so, I kind of am jealous, particularly now living in Puerto Rico, that you Londoners have this wealth. I mean, I don't know what I would do here because there's so much choice that I don't know how I would even choose what concerts to go to and what not to go to, when to go to, and so on. If you live in London, enjoy it because, who knows how long it'll be here. There's the pessimist in it. If you live in any city in the Western world today, enjoy it. I mean, I find objectivists and people interested in objectivism, and I see this on the chat right now. All you want to talk about is Trump and politics and all this garbage. I mean, all that is BS. Who the F cares? I mean, really, at the end of the day, what you should care about is your own life. What you should care about is your own fulfillment. What you should care about is your own flourishing. And to do that, go and live. Go listen to great music. Go to great concerts. Go eat at great restaurants. Go travel the world. Go see the wonders of the world out there. Don't sit depressed in your room thinking about Donald Trump or the latest, I don't know, trait, whatever. I should probably stop after this because now I'm going to go into the whole trade nonsense. Really live. Right? You guys and I, all of us, we obsess way too much about politics. We think about politics, but that politics is not life. And too many of us, of you, waste your life on the politics, on, I like Trump, I don't like Trump, you don't like Trump, you're a fascist, you're this, you're that. Get a life. Go live. There are so many opportunities in the 21st century to live, to make the most of your life, to really. By the way, in Puerto Rico, in a week and a half, I get to see Mozart's Requiem. Yes, I'm so pumped. I hope it's a decent performance. But even Puerto Rico has great classical music. And if you're not into classical music, get into classical music. And it needs you need to train yourself. You need to think about it. You need to exercise the muscle in a sense. You need to get used to it. You need to really engage in it. And so do it. You will thank me more than you'll thank me about anything I say about politics. It doesn't matter. But to really, really get into the music is, wow. Wow, it's before we can make the change in the world out there, before we're going to make any political changes. And most of us, certainly, I am not going to see those changes in my lifetime, and you might not see yours. You make the changes in your own life. That you can do. That you can do today. That you can start today. You can make your life better. You can live a better, happier, more successful life. Whatever you do out there, whatever you do out there. Hey Ross, the music teacher and guitar teacher, he's on the chat on YouTube. He teaches classical music. I think I met Ross here in London. He'll let me know if that's true. I think he's really cool. I'm hoping to come and speak at the guitar teachers convention next year. So my really the point here is, again, you can make your life better. Whether the politics change or not. Now, there's certain really negative outcomes that are horrible for all of us and are really, really, really gonna, can really destroy our lives. But there's nothing you can do about those. I mean, there's nothing I can do about them. And I spend my entire life trying to fight them. I'm realistic about the change that I can make. That I can make in the world. I'm not gonna prevent the next disaster if it's gonna come in the next 10 years. I'm not gonna prevent the next terrorist attack. I'm not gonna prevent Iran from getting nuclear bombs. Nobody is. So I just accept that. I live the best life that I can live, and I fight for the very long-term future because I know what's involved. So to me, much more important than any of the issues I cover is the way I cover them. I hope by the way I cover them, I'm teaching you or helping to guide you to think about the world better. That's my goal. It's not to convince you about Donald Trump. I don't care. I mean, I care, but I don't care. I care that you start using your mind better, that you get away from approaching these issues emotionally, that you get away from being influenced by the crowd, by the collective, by what other people expect, by left versus right, by the Republicans and Democrats, and be an independent, individualistic thinker and live. Make the most of your life. That's my pitch. And London, if you live here, I'm jealous. If you don't live here and you've never been, you should come visit, make a trip here. If you've been here for a little bit, come and spend real time here and get a chance to know the city. The other thing I love is every little alley I take is different. The stores are different, the little shops are different. There's a whole street here that at least used to have used bookstores. They're just these little boutiques, little things that are just amazing. The little restaurants. And again, London in this sense is a great example of the best of the world coming here and trading. And again, somebody called me a globalist on the thing. Yeah. I mean, people from Asia, people from Africa, people from the Middle East, people from all over the world. Now, some of them are barbarians, and I wish they weren't here, but most of them, an overwhelming majority of them, in London, integrated into the London life, are productive, are creative, are building something, are making something, are showing what can happen when the guide to human interaction is trade, it's prosperity, it's shared self-interest that each person engages in, and it's so now, yeah, cost of living unbelievable in London, and that's for a different show, but that's the fault of government, of course. Government policy keep the cost of living so high. All right, that's my pitch for London. I should get paid by the mayor should send me a check for pitching London. I should get something for all the tourism that's going to come here because of me. Objectivist tourism for London. All right. Let's see. All right. I want to take up one issue regarding trade. And I'm a little sick of the topic, but I keep getting the same question over and over again. And when I get a question over and over again, I figure I haven't answered it satisfactorily. And there seems to be a lot of people confused about this. And so I want to try to really focus on this. So this is the type of question that you get, and we'll try to analyze it from a number of different places, because it's a legit question, and the answer is like any answer in economics, like any answer in philosophy, it's not straightforward. It's not simple. So this is the issue. So the Chinese government, or any government out there in the world, subsidizes, let's say steel, or the steel is a hot, rotten example given that most of our steel comes from Canada, but let's take steel. Let's say the government is subsidizing this industry, allowing them to keep costs really, really low at the expense of Chinese taxpayers. But as a consequence of that, the Chinese then come to America and they can sell the steel really cheaply. In a sense, they are dumping what is technically called, I guess, by antitrust regulations, dumping. They're selling the steel, let's say, below cost because they can afford it because the government is subsidizing them. It won't let them go bankrupt. And people are saying, "Well, wait a minute, that's not fair." I mean, there are people in the United States who are working at steel mills. There are entrepreneurs. People never mention entrepreneurs, which is always to me an indication that their thinking is not right, because the entrepreneur is the guy you should really be worried about. But there are entrepreneurs who've invested capital, who've created businesses, and who are running these steel mills and steel businesses, and now they're being undercut by so-called unfair competition because the government of China is using money they've stolen, in immoral fashion, to subsidize these businesses, and it's just not right. And I agree with you. It's not right. It's not right. And Ayn Rand was very clear. The number one purpose of American foreign policy should be to encourage free trade and free markets all over the world. That's what the U.S. government should do. But that's all you can do. The idea that you're going to now put a tax on those goods because it's unfair is both silly, and now it's unfair to the consumers of steel, the people who are actually buying steel, and to consumers broadly. Why shouldn't they benefit? And how do you know how much tax to put on? How do you know how much of the cheapest steel coming in from China is a result of subsidy, And how much of it's a result of just they're more efficient, they're more productive, they're better at making steel than Americans are? How do you know what is what? How do you figure that out? You can't figure it out. There's no way to do it. There's no way to do it. So you put a tariff, which raises the prices. It also then encourages your domestic steel manufacturers to become, in a sense, lazy because they don't have to now compete. They've got a price guarantee that your tariff has given them, that your tax has given them, and now they can do whatever the hell they want. So that's not fair. There is no such thing. Let me be very clear. Yeah, so there is no tax that can... So this is the point. I guess this is the principle. You don't fix a wrong with another wrong. You don't fix the unfairness of what the Chinese government is doing with creating an unfairness by increasing taxes in the United States. You don't correct the violations of rights in China by violating rights in America. The steel industry in the United States will go out of business. That's a reality. So what? Who cares? You're getting cheap steel from China. And the fact is that the capital doesn't go anywhere. So if the Chinese that raise the prices dramatically, then you will resurrect the steel mills. And this happened in the United States. If you go back to the 80s, steel mills shut down and then the market conditions changed and technology improved and steel mills in the United States were resurrected in the 1990s. And you can read about this. So capitalism is a dynamic system. Plants close, they reopen with new technology, they reopen with a new orientation. Maybe somebody in the United States, some brilliant entrepreneur, creates a system to make steel that's much cheaper than what anybody else in the world does. And he innovates like Nucor did in the 1980s. It revolutionized steel manufacturing in the United States. You don't correct a wrong with another wrong. You don't correct the violation of rights in China by violating the rights of Americans. This is the principle. And you're violating the rights of Americans. I want to buy steel from China. Who are you to tell me not, in the name of protecting somebody else's job? What if my job is dependent on cheap steel? What if the U.S. manufacturers of steel turn out to be lazy and unproductive? Is that what we're defending? What are we defending? And how do you determine all of this? And I haven't even gotten to the fact, that the U.S. subsidizes everybody. Like one of the tariffs that Trump has already imposed, for those of you who don't believe he will raise tariffs, one of the tariffs he's already imposed was on solar panels. Well, we subsidize solar panels in the U.S. We heavily subsidize solar panels in the U.S. So why are we raising tariffs? We are the ones creating the unfairness. We're the ones subsidizing. Is China subsidizing more? How do you even measure that? How do you calculate that? How do you calculate it? Because it's not just the direct subsidy. It's the implicit guarantee you won't go bankrupt, which we have in this country. It was too big to fail. And if you look at the 2008 financial crisis, the Federal Reserve bailed out everybody. Anybody who came to the Fed window got money, whether you're a financial institution or not. The Fed massively violated its charter and broke the law, in my view, by bailing out non-financial institutions, including, by the way, foreign banks. So how do you know what the subsidy really is and who's subsidizing whom? The United States is a mixed economy. The United States is not some laissez-faire capitalist country that could pretend that it is better than the rest of the world and the rest of the world is subsidizing and we're not. Look at farming. Look at how massively the United States subsidizes farming. Does that justify the rest of the world raising tariffs on U.S. food? I mean, who suffers if they do? Yes, some of our farmers would suffer, but even more, the people consuming the food in those countries. They're getting cheap food at American taxpayers' expense. And if they were smart, they would lower tariffs to zero and take the cheap food. We're paying for it. Why not take it? So you've got a mixed economy in the United States. You've got a mixed economy in China. It's not the job of government to protect particular industries. It's not the job of government to protect particular employees. It's not the job of government to protect anyone except from physical force. And the Chinese are not using physical force against Americans. They're using physical force against their own people. So they are violating the rights of the Chinese people. So you know what we should do? Say a lot of you, well, some of you, I don't want to badmouth you, some of you, let's violate Americans' rights in order to fix the problem. And this is why, at the end of the day, you shouldn't take an economic approach to any of these issues. You shouldn't take an economic approach to any of these issues first, because you can't. You are not a central planner. You're not smart enough, none of us are, to figure out the economic consequences of subsidies and tariffs and taxes and regulations and limiting this and excluding that. And you're not smart enough. Nobody is. Trump isn't. Navarro, his stupid economic advisor, isn't. Gary Cohen and Mnuchin are not. Bernanke is not. And the people at the Federal Reserve are not. You don't know what the consequences are. That's what economics should teach you. That's what you know, that when you intervene in the economy with taxes and tariffs and regulations and controls, and you try to defend one industry at the expense of the other industry, we know from reading economics in one lesson, you should know from reading economics in one lesson, that the consequences of all that can only be negative. Nothing good can come of it. Nothing good can come of it. So just stop it. It drives me nuts. Stop it. If you're an advocate for individual rights, if you're an advocate for laissez-faire capitalism, then stop it. Stop advocating for taxes. Stop advocating for regulations. Stop advocating for bailing out industries. Stop advocating for all the things that you accuse Democrats of supporting, or that you accuse socialists of supporting, that you accuse the mixed economy of supporting. If you're a laissez-faire capitalist, you should support the U.S. government doing as little as possible. There's no such thing as fair trade. All there is free trade. All there is free trade. And the only rights-respecting, economically sound policy, and the practical and the moral, I did a show on this, the practical moral are the same. The only, I'll say this again, rights-respecting, economically sound trade policy is to unilaterally lower tariffs to zero. I'll say it again. The only rights-respecting, economically sound trade policy is to lower tariffs to zero. Advocating for anything else is putting you on the side of the statists, putting you on the side of the socialists, putting you on the side of Hillary Clinton, putting you on the side of Donald Trump. Maybe you want to be on that side. I certainly don't. Putting you on the side of economic ignoramuses, and putting you on the side of anti-individual rights statists. The only policy, the only thing we should be advocating for in terms of government policy is to violate individual rights less, reduce the violation of individual rights. And then in foreign policy, encourage other countries to violate the rights of their citizens less by instituting free trade and by instituting laissez-faire capitalism. But it's hard to advocate. It's hard to advocate for laissez-faire capitalism in other countries. It's hard to go to China and lecture them about free markets when we don't have them. When many of us are advocating for dissolving free markets in the United States. From when Donald Trump is increasing government intervention in the economy. I just have to say this one thing about Trump. There's a lot of you out there say, oh, he's deregulated so much. He's lowered regulations. You know, you got to recognize how good that is. The more you look at what they've actually done in terms of regulation, the more you realize how little they've deregulated, how little has been done. Now, hopefully he's got another 3 years more will be done, but how little has been done, how little has been achieved. And the more you look at it, the more you realize that the departments like the Treasury Department's actually increasing regulation, not decreasing regulation. And that, so for anybody to argue that this is, raising tariffs is somehow protecting free markets or anything like All right. I think I covered that. Now, I could go into the economics of how, you can always, it's always the case that there's a wonderful book about 19th century Michigan in which the author describes how Dow from Dow Chemical, the original Dow, broke the German cartel. Those days there were no tariffs, and one of the things, for example, that Dow did was the cartel. There was a certain chemical that Dow was producing. It was producing it more efficient than the Germans. So what the Germans decided to do is to sell that chemical in the United States below Dow's prices, and take a huge loss themselves on everything, with the idea that they'd drive them out of business, and then they would raise prices. But to do that, they had to get the money from somewhere. They raised prices in Germany. So in Europe, they raised prices. It's called The Empire Buildings by Budden Folsom, The Empire Buildings by Budden Folsom. In order to achieve this, they raised prices in Europe, and they lowered dramatically prices in the United States. I mean, Dow in the book, Robert Folsom describes the many different ways in which Dow broke the cartel. But the one that kind of sticks in my mind because it's so brilliant, so simple yet brilliant, and is this: what Dow did is he spent huge amounts of money buying the German chemical here in the United States at below cost of production, well below cost of production. He shipped it to Europe and sold it there below their price, and basically destroyed them. And that was the final straw. He'd fought them and fought them and fought them and found ways around them and beaten them over and over and over again. And then he did this and destroyed them. The idea that China can afford to keep subsidizing their steel industry at such a level so that they lose money and lose money and lose money, and that the U.S. can't deal with that U.S. steel manufacturers can't deal with that we as an economy, particularly if we move towards more freedom and less regulations and lower taxes and a real more vibrant capitalist economy, we can't deal with that, is a joke. That says the statists are more powerful than the capitalists. That statism is more powerful than freedom, and that's just not true. So I'm not scared of the Chinese. I'm not scared of the Chinese. Now, there is one issue, and I'm going to end on this, and I'll go to the next topic. There's one issue on which I think we need to be very, very tough on China. And I've said this many times before, and that's the issue of intellectual property rights, or property rights more broadly. If the Chinese steal the intellectual property rights of Product X, then we should not put tariffs on it. You don't put tariffs on stolen property. You ban the importation of that good into the United States. Let's say that there's a manufacturer of phones that has basically stolen Apple's intellectual property in China and is manufacturing phones there and wants to ship into the United States. No, you ban the importation of that phone. You sue them in whatever courts you can. You confiscate their shipments in the high seas. This is what we have a navy for. You tell your allies not to accept shipments of those phones. It is stolen property, and that is the one job of the U.S. government, is to protect the lives and property of American citizens. Yeah, I'm all for that. If you're making and this is done, I think, if you're making fake Gucci purses and you're trying to ship them into the United States, that's illegal. Well, the same is true of intellectual property. So find where they violated the intellectual property and stop them. All right. By the way, just factually, and I said this yesterday, in terms of importing steel from China is the 10th or 11th importer of steel to the United States in terms of volume. The number one importer of steel to the United States is Canada. I don't think Canada is subsidizing its steel industry any more than we're subsidizing our steel industry. They're just better at it. They're more efficient at it. They're more productive at it. their companies are more innovative. And because they've been exporting to the United States and because of NAFTA, they are integrated into the U.S. market in a way that you know, I don't know how why you differentiate even between Canadian steel and American steel. It's the beauty of free trade is who cares? The second largest importer of steel to the United States is Brazil. I don't know why it's cheap to make steel in Brazil, but let me guarantee you this: there's very little likelihood that the Brazilian government could be subsidizing steel because they don't have any money. Brazil is a poor country that has no money. You know, what's the fair issue with Brazilian steel? So everybody wants to focus on China, but that's just a diversion. That's part of the Trump campaign of the hatred of the other, of the demonization of the other. This is what authoritarians do everywhere, and certainly Trump has an authoritarian streak, and certainly the people who voted, many people who voted for Trump, want to see more of this kind of authoritarianism. But the way you rally the people is you create a villain. The Nazis did it with the Jews. This is a reality. It's always the case. Every dictator in history does this. The Putin has done this. Everybody does this. And Trump has been brilliant at it, whether it's illegal immigrants or immigrants more broadly, whether it's the Chinese and the Mexicans and you know, all these others are the enemy. By demonizing them, he builds up his support. And you know, and it's sad. It's tragic. It's pathetic. So Brazil is the second importer. Third importer is Mexico. Again, NAFTA. My sense is that probably a lot of American steel manufacturers went to Mexico to produce steel in Mexico. Why do we care? We still get it's American steel. Who cares? And then the fourth is South Korea. You know, again, you know, does South Korea subsidize steel? Maybe. But they subsidize automobiles and they subsidize their televisions. Should we put a tariff on Samsung televisions because they're subsidized? Oh, Americans don't make televisions, so we're not trying to protect any jobs. All right, I hope I've dealt with this. I hope you know, this is, I don't have to deal with this again because this is a question that keeps coming back, but I think we've settled it. Now, I know you can't ask me questions and that you probably have more questions on this, but if you have more issues around this question of, isn't it, it's fairness of their subsidy, again, stop thinking about these things economically and start thinking about the issue of individual rights. All right. Okay, so let me just mention this event that I'm doing tomorrow. So I'm doing an event tomorrow with Sargon of Akkad here in London. I don't know if you know Sargon Akkad. I've met him a couple of times. He's a nice guy. He's not an objectivist. He's kind of interested in objectivism because he's interested in philosophy, and his interest in philosophy has led him to objectivism, which I find fascinating and interesting and pretty cool. He started by reading Lena Peikoff's Ominous Parallels, and since then has kind of dabbled and studied objectivism. But this is because he seems to be interested in philosophy and interested in reason. Now, it's true that Sargon it dabbles and you know, confronts and talks to and doesn't challenge sometimes all kinds of people that I find offensive that I would never go on a show with. But he doesn't know any better. I don't think you can judge. So he went he's had alt-right people in the show. He's debated alt-right people, which I would not do. He went on anyway, on this other show that I would not go on. But he's not an objectivist. Why, you know, why are you judging him based on standards that don't apply? He's not, I don't think he's pathetic. I think he's confused about certain things. I think he's wrong about certain things. I think he's learning. I have no reason to believe that he cannot learn. But at the end of the day, you know, I have to say that to some extent, I don't care. That is, to the extent that he is helping make objectivism more popular, to the extent that he's encouraging people to read Ayn Rand, to the extent that he is exposing me to a massive new audience, that's great. That's great. He, in and of himself, is not an evil guy. He might go on shows of evil people and not call them out for the evil. But in the culture we live in today, where moral sanction is not understood, and that doesn't surprise me. And that doesn't worry me anywhere near as much. I wouldn't go on those shows because I won't sanction evil. But I don't think Sargon is evil. Sargon is mistaken. Sargon is wrong. A lot of his videos are pretty good. Some of them are not so good. A lot of his stuff is, but he strikes me as smart, intelligent, curious, and wants to think and talk and discuss the objectivist philosophy. The objectivist philosophy. Yeah, somebody says he laughs at six jokes and he's got a nihilistic streak. Yeah, he's a child of the 20, late 20th century, early 21st century. Who isn't out there? I know some objectivists who when you look at their humor, definitely have a nihilistic streak in their humor. I mean, you've got to judge, you've got to judge people appropriately. And of course, the thing about him is that he has a massive audience, and that he's willing to expose that audience to objectivists. And he's not a bad guy. He's not an evil guy, right? Like Molyneux, Stefan Molyneux has an even bigger audience, but I would never go on Stefan Molyneux's because I believe he is an evil guy. But I would go on a lot, I've been on Fox News. I hate Fox News. I despise everything they stand for. But I don't think I'm sanctioning evil by going on Fox News. I've been on Glenn Beck. I don't think I'm sanctioning evil, particularly when I disagree with him constantly on religion. So, you can't isolate yourself so much that you cannot talk to anybody and you cannot be with any. Anyway, you're having this discussion tomorrow. It's not a debate. Sargon himself says that he doesn't want to debate me. He doesn't feel qualified to debate me, and he's right. It is a discussion, and I think he's going to ask me questions on objectivism. My guess is he's going to be very polite and straightforward, and it's going to be good. I've done this before with him, and I thought it went really well. And people learn about objectivism that way. So it introduces objectivism to a whole new audience. Somebody says Fox News is a neo-Nazi territory. Stefan Molyneux. Yes, I said I wouldn't go on Stefan Molyneux. But if Fox News had Stefan Molyneux on, I wouldn't stop going to Fox News. So again, you have to prioritize. Fox News is pretty nasty and pretty bad. And they had people I despise, and they have people I would not go on their shows, but I would go on Fox News. Judging how to do this is not easy. Judging who to talk to and who not to talk to is not easy. And I'm quite open to the idea that I make mistakes with regard to this, that I give people too much credit, that I don't go on people that I should go on pe with, that I do go on that shows that I shouldn't go on. But I really try to think it through and figure out who's who and who's worthy and who should be engaged and who shouldn't be engaged with. Anyway, the news about the event tomorrow, which is going to be at King's College, and we'll have, for those of you not haven't heard yet, we'll have safe space monitors to make sure that we don't insult anybody and we don't offend anybody. And the event supposedly will be, I guess, closed if there's too much offense going on. Somebody asked me if I'd go on British television. Of course, I'd go on British television. Why wouldn't I? But the thing that's going to happen tomorrow, which makes this a thousand times more exciting, is that we're going to be protested. In particular, I am going to be protested. So I'm pretty happy about this, in a sense that I'll get center stage. I'm kidding, but it appears that the pro-Palestinian group on campus, which opens also has to be the social justice warrior group on campus, that also happens to be the gender whatever group on campus and everything else, is launching a protest. They've launched a Facebook page condemning me to hell, calling me a fascist and a racist, and they've got quotes there of me talking about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, in which I'm pretty pretty radical, as you know. They are going to be out there with signs. They're going to be yelling. They have demanded that the administration cancel the event, not allow it to happen. And they are going to try to destroy the event and make it impossible. So I think it's going to be fascinating to watch the Safe Space Monitors handle the demonstration. What are the Safe Space Monitors going to do? Because I am going to be really offended by these protesters. And I don't know, I might have to ask the Safe Space Monitors for a teddy bear to hug and a blanket to cuddle up into so that I can feel safe. Because I, you know, here I am, a guest at King's College London, and I'm going to be offended. And, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, maybe they can play soft music or something to calm my nerves down. Anyway, it's going to be interesting because will the event happen? I certainly hope so. We have about 270 people RSVP'd. So a lot of people are coming. And please, if you RSVP'd, please come. Please show up. And, you know, don't let the fact that they are going to be protesters stop you from coming and hopefully defending your beliefs and defending, more importantly than anything, defending your right to listen, your right to engage, your right to hear me and Sargon, who you might disagree with or you might agree with. Have a discussion, have a civilized discussion. So I encourage you to come. If you weren't planning on coming, you should come. It first of all, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be fun. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be, you know, who knows what'll happen? I don't know. There's security, so I don't think we have to worry for our physical safety. You never know with these nuts. So it could get violent. I don't know. I've never worried for my safety, even though I've been attacked many times and have been physically attempted to attack a number of times. But the security is usually pretty good, and hopefully it will be at King's College. I have no reason to think it isn't. Come join us. Come support the cause. Support the cause of free speech, more importantly than anything else. Come support that. So it should be interesting. Now, you know, I hope there's not going to be carnage. I hope that they participate. I hope that they ask some questions about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I hope that they ask questions about the state of the world. I'm eager to answer those questions. I hope they read some of my quotes aloud and let me respond and let me defend those quotes. That'll be cool and that'll be appropriate. Of course, I think that if that happens, I will offend a lot of people and the Safe Space Marshals might have to shut the event down. So the whole thing about what constitutes offending and when do the Safe Space Marshals actually engage and whose emotions they care about. Are my emotions count at all? Does anybody's emotions count? That in and of itself is interesting. It should be fun to watch. You guys should come. Anyway, I'm kind of torn right now. I was thinking of taking my equipment and trying to live stream, and I think I will, but I'm a little worried that if things get rowdy, that the equipment gets stolen or gets damaged or gets knocked down and stuff like that. On the other hand, I think it's going to be important to document whatever happens. So Sargon will definitely have his equipment. I don't think he's planning to live stream. I think he's just planning to record and play later, which is fine. I think it's important to have evidence there. So I think I will bring the equipment. I will try to live stream. My equipment is finicky in terms of live streaming. I've managed to rig it up in the room. I managed to rig it up at LSC the other night. I don't know that I'll manage to rig it up in at King's College. We will see. I hope so. And if I do, and you guys are watching, it's at I think it starts at 6 p.m. London time, which is 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 o'clock East Coast time, and 2 o'clock Puerto Rican time. So you guys can watch it live stream. If it gets rowdy, I'll point the camera towards the protesters again. If I'm actually in a position, sorry, it's 6:30, so 10:30, 1:30 on the Pacific Coast and East Coast. Again, if I can get the live stream technologically to work. If not, then I just apologize, and you'll have to watch the video that we produce of it, and we'll send that out. In terms of people asking me to come and speak, Cambridge has not asked me. They invited me once to speak, and the attendance was pathetic. So if they ever invited me again, I'd kind of re require kind of a guaranteed attendance. Cambridge often invites me, so I've been to Cambridge many times to speak. Not Cambridge, Oxford has invited me many times. Cambridge, only a few times, and attendance has not been very good. So if somebody can arrange for me to speak at Cambridge, that would be great. I've spoken in Romania, somebody said. I've spoken in Australia, but I'd love to come to Australia again, so you need to invite me and you need to raise the money to make it possible. I'm expensive, that's the problem. Not so much because I take an expensive fee, it's because I travel everywhere business class, and business class is expensive. So if you want me to come, raise the money and invite me. That's the pitch. I will come anywhere pretty much. There are very few countries in the world I will not go to if you can raise the money to get me there. In appropriate style, right? All right, I don't know why I'm doing this topic. I guess I saw something on Facebook. On I think my show's page, and it just infuriates me, and so I want to say something about this and just get this off my chest. This is the purpose of saying this, and this comes up with regard to Molyneux and stuff and on all these places. There is this idea there's this term that people use called race realism. Now, let me just say that race realism is nothing but racism. There is no race realism. Now, there are people out there who are claiming that this is science and that objectivists, because they are biased, because they don't want to look there, because they're evading, don't want to recognize this as that science. So let me be very clear. This is not science. This is massive pseudoscience where what is being used is pseudo statistics, false use of statistics. Statistics, as I've said many times in the show, is a sophisticated field. It is not trivial to understand how to use statistics and to use them well. The whole idea of race realism, so-called science, this so-called nonsense, is not science. It's BS statistics that evade a whole series of things from, so this has to do with the IQ stuff that I've talked about before. From what does IQ actually measure? What extent is IQ dependent on culture, on environment, on upbringing? There's plenty of evidence that if you take twins and if they are raised in different families, their IQs are dramatically different after a few years. Lots of issues relating to what is IQ actually measuring, and then what are the determinants of IQ. But even the question of what is IQ measuring? What are the components of intelligence? How do you properly measure the different components of intelligence? There is a whole science of intelligence and how to measure intelligence and what is intelligence. But the idea that there is any validity or interest or value or purpose in categorizing people around gross racial categories and then measuring their IQ somehow, or measuring their, there is no purpose to that other than racism. There is no purpose to that other than collectivism. There is no purpose to that other than trying to segregate people based on their racial characteristics. Because if you're hiring something, what matters to you is the intelligence of the individual. And the intelligence of the individual, because the variability within groups is far greater than the variability between groups, the individual's intelligence is not determined by the group's intelligence. It just makes me so mad, these things. I don't know, racism is something that I find particularly offensive, particularly stupid, particularly barbaric, and that there are people who call themselves objectivists and who then dabble in racism and pretend then they're not racists. I find infuriating, infuriating. Eugenics. The whole field of eugenics in the early part of the 20th century, measuring the size of skulls, looking at the facial features, the shape of the nose or whatever. The Germans were masters of this. This was science. Science. It was science. And we objectivists evaded that. We didn't consider eugenic science. Give me a break. It wasn't science. It was BS masquerading as science. It was BS racism, collectivism, the grossest form of collectivism, the most primitive form of collectivism, the ugliest form of collectivism, masquerading as science. You know, and people like Stephen Molyneux are out and out racist. This is not neo-Darwinism. Neo-Darwinism is giving it way too much credit, right? Way too much credit. Because it's not Darwin. It has nothing to do with Darwin, right? Now, there are genetic differences between groups, and there are contexts in which that is important. And in those contexts, it is legitimate to study them. In those contexts, it is interesting to study them. In those contexts, it is important to study them. Health, for example. Now, I don't know if you consider Jewish a race. I don't know what race means. I don't know what race means. Let me say that again. I don't think there is such a thing as races. I don't know what it means. Where's the borderline? Given that most of us are mutts, if you actually look at our genetics. What does it mean? We all came from Africa. So what does it mean? So what is the race of Jews? I don't know. But the fact is, the Jews from Eastern Europe are susceptible to certain disease more so than anybody else. So if you go into a hospital and you have certain type of abdominal pain, one of the questions they're going to ask you is, are you Jewish of Eastern Europe descent? I once had a false diagnosis based on this. They almost killed me, literally killed me. I was 14. I had a burst appendix, and these stupid, arrogant doctors at Mass General in Boston diagnosed it as some rare Ashkenazi Jewish disease. And my father, who's a doctor, was standing next to them and was pulling his hair out because he knew my appendix was bursting. And until he went up and got the chief of medicine and dragged him down there, and the chief of medicine looked at me and touched my stomach and said, get this kid into the surgery. His appendix is bursting, and it had leaked by that point. Nobody listened because these doctors were so enamored with the fact that I was an Ashkenazi Jew, and therefore I must be suffering from this Ashkenazi Jewish disease, which manifests itself in stomach ache. So, yeah. So if you have dark skin, that could be important to, I don't know, vitamin D absorption. And the darker the skin, I think the less vitamin D you absorb. So maybe you need a supplement more. Yeah. So there's a context in which there's a science. But first there has to be a context. Intelligent is an attribute of the individual. Intelligence is not gained from the group. Intelligence, particularly in its application to the workplace, is not genetically determined. Because I know really smart people who come from long lines of really smart people who I would never, ever, ever hire. I know pretty mediocrely smart people who I would hire in an instant because they're hardworking and they have integrity. And I would much prefer that on somebody who has the high IQ. The whole issue is a bogus issue. And is an attempt, just like the Nazis use eugenics, it's an attempt for racists to hide behind scientists. And I am here, if you're involved, and if you claim to be a race realist, please unfriend me, unsubscribe, go away. I'm not interested in you. I don't like racists. There's nothing I find more disgusting than racists. And to some extent, I find people who pretend not to be racist, but who are, even more disturbing. So, you know, just horrible. Anyway, yeah, I know. So now all the people who want to attack me for my position in Israel are coming out. Yeah, come on, bring it on. I've said, by the way, just open borders for Israel. I've said that in an ideal world, where there's peace in the Middle East, where Israel is not threatened, and there's no anti-Semitism in the world, I believe in open borders for Israel. I do not believe in any racially, ethnically based countries, except in an emergency where you're trying to defend yourself, and this is the only way to defend yourself. And that is in a once in a 100-year type emergency where you have to found a country in order to defend yourself because you're so hatred, so despised, so murdered, so much destruction is aimed at you as an individual because of your ethnic group, because of your identity, that the only way you can defend yourself is by gathering around it with a group that is similar to you and establishing country. And that is a sad event. That is not something, the need for the existence of Israel is a sad, sad, sad statement about the world. I wish we lived in a world where Israel didn't have to exist. All right. I think that's it. I could talk about the Italian elections, but let's wait and see what happens, and maybe some of our Italian friends can give us some color about the entertainment that is Italian politics. It's far more entertaining than I understand. Somebody's asked me if I've read Douglas Murray's Strange Death of Europe. I've read big chunks of it. I haven't finished it. I've actually started Steven Pinker's book, and I'm reading both of them at the same time, but I haven't finished it. But there's a lot in Douglas Murray's book that I agree with. Douglas Murray, just like me, at the end of the day, places the cause of the death of Europe not on Muslims, but places the cause of the death of Europe, on the fact that Europe has lost its ideology, it's lost its identity, it's lost its backbone, it's lost its confidence, and it won't assimilate the immigrants. So Douglas Murray, there's a passage there where he actually acknowledges that if Europe actually stood for something, if Europe believed in itself, if Europe advocated for the right values, that it would have no problem assimilating the immigrants that have come here. It is a lack of interest in assimilating, a lack of wanting to assimilate, a lack of our ability to assimilate because of our own weakness that is the problem in Europe. Now, I disagree with Douglas Murray about what the nature of Europe is. He's far too beholden to the idea that the essence of Europe is a Christian tradition instead of an Enlightenment tradition. I believe that Europe is an Enlightenment culture, and until Europe understands that it's an Enlightenment culture, it will lose. Now, Douglas Murray is an atheist himself, but he still believes Europe's essential culture is Christian. And I think that is where he's completely and utterly wrong. All right, I'm going to end it. It's an hour and 2 minutes. I've gone 2 minutes over. I'll have to comment on Trump's comment on Xi, the Chinese dictator, another time. It's too good of a comment to pass up. I will do that. All right. I hope you guys all had a great weekend. I hope you had as much fun as I did. I hope you have a great week ahead of you. You should tune in to the event tomorrow. If you don't tune in, make sure to watch it not live, whenever we put it up on YouTube. In addition, do me a favor. If you're not subscribed to my channel on YouTube, please subscribe. If you're not supporting me on Patreon, please support me. All of you can afford $2 a month, one less coffee. Not that I'm expecting you to sacrifice your coffee, but you've probably got $2 a month that you can help support me on Patreon. I'd appreciate that if you really supported me on Patreon. I will be back in the States on Thursday to do a talk in Denver, Colorado. I will then be flying home to Puerto Rico on Saturday, and then I'll get back on schedule. I'm hoping to do a show with Amy on Sunday. We'll see. I haven't talked to Amy about it, but I'm hoping to do that. Over the next week while I'm in London, tomorrow I'll be live streaming. Maybe on Tuesday I'll have time to do a show. Probably not on Wednesday, although maybe Thursday I'll be flying all day. Maybe I'll do a show for Denver. So I might be doing shows every day, because what the hell? I'm in a hotel room all by myself. I might as well engage with you guys and might as well have an opportunity to chat. The talk tomorrow is at 6:30 London time. 6:30 London time. Please come. If you can, if you're in London, Oxford, if you're anywhere in the UK area, get the train, get on a train. Weather's not going to be that bad tomorrow, and come and participate in this event. It could be pretty dramatic. It could be pretty exciting. If you're in the United States or if you're anywhere in the world, I know there are a bunch of people here from all over the world. I hope you listen in, and I hope you keep listening and supporting the show. Please, now, before you forget, share the video I just did. It's pretty good, actually. What I said about living your life in classical music, that was good. The trade stuff was good, and even the race realism was good. So a lot of content here for you to share. So please press that share button on YouTube or on Facebook. Let your friends and their friends know that this is something worth watching. All right. Let's see. How do I turn it off? Good night, everybody.